For we come on the ship they call the Mayflower. We come on the ship that sails the moon. We come in the ages most uncertain hours and sing an American tune. Oh, and it's alright. It's alright, it's alright. You can be forever blessed. Still, tomorrow's gonna be another working day. Trying to get some rest. That's all I've tried, to get some rest.
Earthwatch was brought to you with portions on recording. This is WBAI New York.
Thank you.
and good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. This is a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. Normally, I go on with my theme, but we have what I am hoping will be a very information-filled and exciting show. Because our guest is David Brin. Let me just see if this is working at all. David, are you there?
I am indeed, Jim.
Ooh,
I'm glad to be back on Hour of the Wolf.
Great. I know the third time you're on the show. Is this the first time that we actually have you live on the air?
I think so.
I think so, too. I know that we recorded once in your agent's office, another show we did like almost 15 years ago.
Time creeps up on you. It's only yesterday, it seems, that I was the young whippersnapper, the hot young guy in science fiction.
Yeah, well.
Now I'm a sage old-timer.
There you go. You've become one of the past masters, is that fair?
Yeah, well, I'm not a grandmaster, but I'm
yet.
The blurbs on the covers of the books.
Yeah, well, I know, by dead people.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, because I'm looking at the brand new book, just out from Tor, by the way, called Existence. And the first major blurb that I see below the Stephen Baxter and Temple Grandin one is from Tom Dish.
Yes, who's not giving blurbs very much anymore.
But not for lack of, I mean, and by the way, Tom Dish had a thing about the 4th of July. Today, in fact, would be on the 4th, is when he blasted off this mortal coil.
Wow. Well, you know, one can have some control over these things emotionally, for instance, Mark Twain was born at the apparition of Halley's Comet at around 1835, and he was absolutely determined to go out with the comet in 1910.
Mm-hmm.
I came in with the comet. I would greatly disappoint me if I failed to go out with it. And he did.
There you
go. So, in any event, the notion is that, I went to the same high school as Ray Bradbury, who passed away just a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And, he, of course, 30 years later. But I miss Ray terribly. But the thing is that he taught me so much about what it takes to be not only a writer that I learned from reading his works, but also his public attitude, his attitude towards civilization. You wouldn't think so from his writings, but, you know, you read an average Ray Bradbury story and you want to commit suicide because, you know, he plumbs the deepest, darkest corners of how human beings can go wrong. And yet, the amazing thing is that he was an optimist.
He really was.
Probably in pretty much the same way that I am. People accuse me of being a major optimist because I think that human beings can work their way through their problems. Not that they always will. but, you know, I believe the best definition of science fiction that I ever heard was that it's the genre that considers the possibility, just the possibility, that children might learn from the mistakes of their parents. And it's proved to be a possibility. There are many, many times when children do, and they decide, I won't do that. And they don't. And that's been pretty much the story of the Enlightenment the last couple of hundred years. So the reason why I'm an optimist and why Ray was an optimist is not because we're naturally sunny people, but because we're forced to admit by our knowledge of history that this is an amazing time, and we have been very, very favored and very, very lucky, and that Ray considered to be, in gratitude, to be the lowest of human traits. And cynicism just struck him and strikes me as being surly and ungrateful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a playground bully attitude, you know, the curled lip, the sneer that we all ran into on the playground.
Well, I only met him twice, but he always had a sunny attitude. And I've met you, I guess, about 5 times, including some late-night encounters at world cons or whatever. And I would say you're always somehow cheerful.
Well, you know, people ask about the roots of science fiction, and I think it was a poorly named field.
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah,
I think it should have been named speculative history, and here's the reason. Only 1 in 10 science fiction authors are scientifically trained as I am. But almost all of us are deeply steeped in history. And it was such a shame that Americans are so poorly informed about history. Remind me later and I'll tell you about a weird result from an international study of science literacy, by the way, that I'd like to tell you about.
Mm-hmm.
But most Americans know so little history, and they do not know the context of the miracle that they're living in. But science fiction authors have a tendency, whether they're fantasy writers or alter tech or other kin or steampunk, they tend to know a lot of history. And that's what we have in common. And if you look upon science fiction as the extrapolation of the greatest of all stories, and that is the human story, history. Extrapolation to parallel possibilities of what if something happened other than, and extrapolation to into the future, continuing the saga. And the thing is that when you do these extrapolations, then the premise is either one of nostalgia and we're doomed to repeat errors. And this is the kind of sci-fi and fantasy that the literarcy types on the college campuses like, because it reinforces the notion of so-called eternal human verity. But the main tradition of science fiction is rebellious against that.
Mm-hmm.
The eternal human verities. What eternal human verities? Kids don't have to make the same mistakes as their parents. And when they do make the same mistakes, then you get a better tragedy. Some of your readers, listeners may have seen the movie, Gregory Peck movie, On the Beach.
Oh, God.
Yeah. About nuclear war.
Yeah, from the Neville Shute novel.
The greatest movie that was ever made by anybody, Dr. Strangelove.
Ah, yes.
Or Soylent Green. These were all scary stories about horrible mistakes that didn't have to happen. And I think that's so much more powerful a tragedy than the tragedy that Aristotle prescribed when he described Greek tragedy in his work The Poetics, where he said, you know, look at Oedipus, torn apart by fates, no hope, no chance. Well, you know, you can feel sorry for a fish that's been hooked and gaffed. But if it's inevitable and there's no chance, then where's the drama? I mean, a modern person watching Oedipus feels the same emotions of sympathy that if you had watched Aeschylus or Sophocles 2,500 years ago, except for one thing. What you really want to do is leap onto the stage, put a bullet in his head, and then spin the chambers and go god hunting. So, in any event, I guess what I'm saying is that this extrapolation of history is, I think, what makes some of the literary types uncomfortable with science fiction. But I think that it is actually our glory, because ours is the genre that is interested in the effects of change. And if anything has been proved in the last 100 years, change happens.
Yeah. Now, literary types of late, I wouldn't say they've been exactly embracing the genre, but they have been willing to cross the line into the genre. And, so, well, Michael Chabon, he has embraced it, but others like Margaret Atwood cross the line right within the genre, but say, but I'm not really doing that.
Except that in the last year or so, we've seen a breakthrough in that regard. A number of people who had disavowed the name science fiction, some who had done it intermittently at their own whim, like Ursula Le Guin, and others who had allowed sycophants and flatterers to make them take that path of denying who they were, like Atwood.
Yeah.
A number of them in the last few years have said, what was I thinking? You know, screw you. I've always loved science fiction. I have some differences. I have some of my own reservations about Atwood's work. But the fact of the matter is that when she does what Einstein called the Gedanken experiment, the thought experiment, and saying, what if this? What if that? I perfectly respect that.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't she who claimed that The Handmaid's Tale wasn't science fiction. It was her flatterers. It was her sycophants. And just a few weeks ago, The New Yorker magazine published an entire issue devoted to science fiction.
Which is almost the unthinkable. It is...
Almost the unthinkable. I'll have heart failure when The Atlantic does it.
That's exactly what I was just thinking. Although, The New Yorker has opened the door, haven't they?
Yeah, well, the thing is, what happened was...
It's almost a dare to The Atlantic.
About every 7 years, The Atlantic or Harper's would commission a hit piece against sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
And, I guess about 14 years ago, Tom Dish was asked to do it. He was paid well to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people were hurt in the field because, you know, he talked about flaws in science fiction, and he was a very smart guy. And he skewered a bunch. But there was a place in his essay where he was clearly building up to, although I've said all this, clearly there are exceptions and there are places where science fiction rises to the very highest standard. And he was implying that he was getting to that, and then it leaps to the end. He was edited.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the thing is, this was a cause of great disappointment to me, because just 3 months earlier, I think it was about 6 months earlier, he had written a glowing review of my novel, Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So somewhere in the excised spaces there, he did my career a big favor, but I never got to see it.
Yeah, well, we could, and I have done more than one entire show about the contradictions that were Tom Dish.
Well, you know, and contradictions are us. My blog is entitled Contrary Brin. You know, I like contradictions.
Right? Mm-hmm.
All of my libertarian friends, and I've given speeches to, I'm the only science fiction author who's given a keynote at a national party's political convention, the Libertarian Party.
I'm surprised they didn't get Heinlein.
Well,
he didn't like them, but they liked him.
Yeah, well, and that's the problem, is they didn't get the hint.
Right.
I told them, you know, half of you are going to give me a standing ovation while defending me from being lynched by the other half.
Yeah, but that's the nature of libertarians, isn't
it? Well, things have gotten much worse. The other half that tried to lynch me is now completely in charge of the movement. But the point is that I poke away at them because I have hopes that they'll become a mature political movement at the negotiating table, at the American negotiating table. And so they think I come across as a liberal. But when I'm with liberals, I hate getting into, you know, any kind of Me Too-ism. All I impression I give them is that, hey, you guys have got to read Adam Smith. He was called the first liberal. So, you know, I'm ornery, contrary.
Well, here we're just, you know, like far lefties.
Well, look, I have nothing but contempt for the so-called left-right political axis.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's utterly lobotomizing. If you take a room full of 50 people and ask them to define it with a pad and paper, no two definitions will be the same.
Yeah, I hope you know that by saying this, you are really annoying all of my colleagues here at Pacifica Radio, and I wish you would do some more.
Well, mind you, I do believe that if you are going to use the left-right political axis as a metaphor, I believe that one wing of that axis is far more crazy right now and more damaging to the Republic than the other wing.
Mm-hmm.
But the chief difference is that they both have crazy wings who are not only dogmatic, purist, Platonist,
deaf,
unable to negotiate, unable to listen to criticism.
Right. Correct.
Totally lacking in sense of humor. But also, unable to negotiate, but also opposed to the basic messages of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The chief difference...
Which is remarkable when one considers the capability of science fiction to look at political systems, find the comedy and the drama and the truth in it.
But
science fiction is the best...
Criticism is the only known antidote to error. That's an aphorism of my own, Cito Kate, that's really spread across the web. And I bring this into life in all of my works. At the end of every one of my novels, you'll find 40 to 50 names of pre-readers,
mm-hmm,
who I circulate manuscripts to, I circulate early editions to, so that I can get the feedback, so I can find out, you know, where it dragged at all, where I got too lectury. Where
you were group sourcing before it was popular to do so.
Well, I consider it to be basic industrial quality control. And as I got better at storytelling, and I suppose I'm pretty good at it now, what I did was I realized if I'm continuing to challenge myself, then I'll always be a beginner at some level in some way. And the way to find out is to constantly be stretching the envelope and to try to do new things, as I have in my new novel.
By the way, let's mention it again, Existence,
it's
from Tor Books.
But to finish the point,
yeah.
This notion that criticism is the main antidote to error is rooted in the great tragedy of the last 6,000 years of human history. Why did we always slump into a pyramid-shaped social structure with a few at the top lording it over everybody below?
Mm-hmm.
Feudalistic in shape.
And pretty much every society around the world in any point of history.
If they had agriculture. If they had agriculture and metal tools, then big men would gang together, use those metal tools to take other men's women and wheat.
And other people would say that it was the creation, I think, of, using the word literally, civilization, the creation of cities in which stores, the hunter-gatherers, as I understand, and I know all this because I was watching a documentary like yesterday, the hunter-gatherers would not necessarily leave anything behind. They would use what they had, and it was a more egalitarian society.
Well, I think that may be romanticized.
Mm-hmm.
From what I've been able
to... I'm not preaching this. I'm quoting something I heard.
I believe that has in some ways been propaganda from the left, as there is propaganda in favor of feudalism on the right.
Mm.
I don't see an awful lot...
That's why I took to it, because I'm a lefty, so... Okay.
I don't see an awful lot of progress in human existence,
mm-hmm,
until our recent enlightenment. Mind you, in Existence, I talk
about... Now, when you say our recent enlightenment, how many years are you giving that?
250 years.
Very good. Okay.
But pretty much since Adam Smith wrote Wealth of Nations, and then more importantly, The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Hmm.
But the point is, you know, in existence, I talk about how there were other renaissances. For instance, about 35,000 years ago, suddenly, Neanderthals and Cro-Magnons had been living side by side, which was pretty much identical stone tool sets, very simple, for about 1 million years. And suddenly, that tool set multiplied by a factor of 10 or more. New types of blades, new uses of bone and sewing needles, new types of clothes, and the dead were being buried with flowers and with grave goods, and you had all those marvelous cave paintings. And suddenly there are signs in the bones of slavery and signs in the bones of genocide. And we became much more powerful and for well or ill. And so there was a renaissance then. And the novel existence is basically about whether or not we're heading into another of those periods of speed up. But I just wanted to finish the thought there that we should abandon the left-right political axis if for no other reason because it's French. I mean, that's a good enough reason.
It really is.
But the other thing is, throughout all that time, rulers were able to avoid the one thing that would have enabled them to rule better, and that is criticism. Because we're delusional. Now, I earn my living by catering to the delusions of people who pay me to weave very, very high-quality, industrial-grade incantations that take them to other worlds, into the future, expose them to ideas, while having adventures with plausible characters who are having fun and in a lot more trouble than the reader hopes that he or she ever will be. So that talent for imagining is wonderful. But what happens is we all delude ourselves. And the only way we can escape those delusions is with the criticism of others. That's why I circulate my manuscripts to 50 people. But here's the incredible irony. That this one thing that would make us better, make our leaders better at statecraft, for example, is the one thing that human beings seek to avoid above all else. We seek to avoid the criticism that could improve us. And here's the deal. There's people out there who are eager to supply for you what you need. And they'll do it for free. They're called your enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And they are glad to criticize you. And if you had the right attitude, you'd say to somebody who's criticizing you, well, you know, this part is bull. This part of what you just said is bull. This part, well, maybe 5% of it's okay. But, you know, these other couple of things, you actually hit me pretty hard with those. I'm going to go home and I'm going to improve all my product or my policy or my invention or my theory. Thanks for the favor. Thanks for helping me to be even better.
But aren't there those people that think that's bad PR?
Oh, well, then leaders avoid criticism for good reason, because if there's open criticism, there's a chance they won't be the leader anymore.
Right.
But, you know, imagine how we'd all be speaking French today if Napoleon had listened to the criticism like, Napoleon, your emperorness, I hear they have snow in Russia. You know, that we'd all be speaking French today.
You really have a Franco issue there, don't you?
No, well, actually, I lived in Paris for a couple of years when my wife had a postdoc there, and it was fun. It was good. I'm poking at the French because one of the early American science fiction authors, Mark Twain, used to do it.
Yes, there's a grand tradition of it. But also a Mr. Delaney, by starting with Samuel R., very much finds many of the roots of science fiction in French writing of the 19th century.
Oh, well, I channeled Jules Verne for that anthology, Global Dispatches. Did you ever see it? It was a clever notion. They got 24 sci-fi authors, each to choose a literary figure from the late 19th century and to write a story as if that literary figure had found himself in the Martian invasion of H.G. Wells.
Oh, my God. No, I don't. Oh, I'd love that book, and no, I don't think I've seen
it. So we, Greg Benford and I wrote a story called Paris Conquers All, written by Jules Verne as Paris is being invaded by the three-legged Martian invaders of H.G. Wells. And it was loads of fun because Verne is an eternal optimist and thinks everything can be solved with technology.
Yes.
Whereas the ones done from the point of view of Joseph Conrad and, well, several others were very, very dark. There was one from the point of view of Winston Churchill. But
oh my.
In any event, let's move along. I'm sure you have a lot of questions.
Why don't we like roll back a little bit? We sort of like got into fascinating talk to begin with, and we've mentioned the novel, but we haven't told. Surely there may be one or two listeners who don't know who you are. So why don't we do a brief explanation of the fact that Existence is your first adult science fiction book in, what, about 10 years?
About 10 years. I had a draft of a short story collection. I've had a collection of my essays and book reviews. I've had a young adult novel that won the Hal Clement Award for Young Adult.
And that's actually the last time we did the interview is when that came out.
Yes, and that's going to come out again, thoroughly revised and doubled in size.
Oh, cool.
pardon me. Well, why don't you go ahead and say what you want about me?
Well, okay. I mean, let's start with the fact that you have been writing great science fiction. By the way, for all of the talk of the depth and high concept that all these books that David Brin has written, one should mention that they're rollicking fun adventures. They're good reads.
That's kind of you.
And, well, I always look forward to them. They're always, I always enjoy reading them. I know that, like, oh boy, some of them are absolutely, utterly, as far as I'm concerned, comedic. I certainly hope that Kiln People, that's K-I-L-N, as in clay, was intended as a comedy. So I hope.
Well, it was certainly intended to be funny.
Okay, good.
It
you know,
deals
so
with somewhat serious issues, but.
But on the surface,
The Pun Festival was certainly, it always makes you nervous when you try to do comedy because it's not easy.
It's not easy. Few do it well. There's Terry Pratchett and Douglas Adams and occasionally Neil Gaiman.
Terry Pratchett.
Yeah, Pratchett is David Hartwell once said in a panel that reading a Terry Pratchett novel is guaranteed to lower your blood pressure.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, that's a favor for everybody.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, and it's utterly true. And I had exactly the same reaction to Kiln People. Other books like The Postman merely absorbed me. And vice versa, all the way through. Some books I read quickly. I read Kiln People the first time quickly. The Postman I read very slowly because I was taking in that environment.
Well, you know, The Postman, people ask me questions, of course, about Kevin Costner all the time because of the movie.
Yeah.
And sometimes they're surprised by how, you know, even-tempered I am about it.
Now, I'm going to say something that will shock a lot of people. I like that film.
Well, you know, I'm asked all the time about the film, and I have to tell you, that on balance, I like it. Now, do I think it would have been improved if Kevin Costner had treated me at all decently and hadn't been a jerk and had even bought me one beer? Of course.
I don't know any of those stories.
Yeah, well,
I just saw the movie on the screen and said, yeah, I enjoyed that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you know, look, my attitude is that, first off, the first few screenplays that they had before he came on board were just flat-out evil. They reversed every moral point I was trying to make in the story. So when he comes along, and he isn't very nice to me, but he and Brian Helgeland come up with a script that is should have been reworked and should have been rewritten and should have talked to me and scooped out and threw away most of the brains from the book, but restored its basic heart message.
The basic heart message is there, the basic premise is there, and, I mean, taking a look at what has happened so often to, say, the works of Philip K. Dick, how often do the movies have anything to do with the books?
Right, and so what, you know, I think, when I saw his rendition, his portrayal of the main character from my book, I said, well, all right, that's the main character from my book. It's extremely well done. It's just with about 40 IQ points scooped out.
Yeah.
But the situation, the dilemmas that the character faces, the ways in which he faces them.
The fact that they took a risk in making it a long movie, which I thought if it had been another half hour, that would have been fine by me.
Well, the...
In order to tell the story.
The other aspect to it, besides the heart, that I felt very good about was Costner's use, was basically how pretty it was. Costner, if he had been born pig ugly, would have more Academy Awards now than he has,
mm-hmm.
because he would have been a cinematographer. I think that his movies are just flat out musically and visually stunning. And we saw that in Dances with Wolves.
Yeah.
We see it in Open Range and in The Postman.
And in Wyatt Earp.
Right. And so if you go to The Postman expecting it to be dumb and you turn down that dial, then you're going to have something that's hugely big-hearted, over-eager. It's like having a golden retriever leap on your lap and lick your face for 3 hours. And worse things have happened in the history of cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I often have such low expectations of cinema. And occasionally they come through, and occasionally movies are lambasted when, in fact, they're sometimes rather good. I watched for the second time, for the first time at home, the movie John Carter. And I have to say, I really liked it.
Well, there was much to like, actually.
But it was a lambasted film, and the head of Disney got fired for its release.
Right. Well, look, you know, the fact is that the town, Hollywood, has no courage whatsoever these days.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important that we try to move in the direction of, you know, so much money is being made with science fiction. And even the guys who did it right before, you know, seem to be ignoring what the story is about and what they're trying to accomplish. I mean, I was very saddened by Prometheus and vexed by Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Avatar, it would have been so easy to have the film not be a betrayal of a civilization that's been very good to James Cameron. He wants us to be better. He sincerely wants us to do better. And he's doing what the left often does, and that is berating us and using guilt trips to try to get us to decide to be better. The problem is he's still stuck in the 60s. Nowadays, anybody who is, could be guilt-tripped into wanting to save the world already has been. And the problem with pessimism in science fiction is rife in the movies, and that is that it, you know the old story, you get more flies with honey than with vinegar.
Mm-hmm.
If all you're doing is wagging your finger and chiding people, they're going to walk away and go the other direction. And this is what's happened politically in America as well. I mean, the argument should be hands down in one direction, but that direction has been so busy chiding that, you know, what we need is some encouragement as well. And the fact is that, you know, you and I, we've grown up seeing a civilization take on ancient nasty habits that were traditional and standard for thousands of years, racism, sexism, all sorts of nasty things that our beloved and decent parents took for granted. This is an accomplishment. This is amazing.
It is. It is.
Racism and sexism haven't been defeated, but they've been driven into ill repute. And what I would have done is advise Cameron just 5 minutes at the beginning of the film. Pause and show that there, this colony has a very decent, fine colonial governor appointed by the political process from Earth. And he and his colleagues are doing their best. And they are negotiating with the Na'vi, who are not your archetype, obstinate, smug Sioux warriors who assume they know everything, but instead are like the Cherokee. They're actually curious about the universe. And these two groups of moderates are about to strike a deal. When there's an explosion, they're all killed. And now all of a sudden, the horrible company guy is loose to do his horrible things. And the rest of the movie can unfold exactly the same. But what have you said with that 5 minutes? You've said, hey, look, we're fumbling around. Our descendants may be better than us. And then bad stuff happens. That's a very different story than what he told, which is humans are unadulteratedly hopeless, vicious, horrible, and not worth talking to, except it lone individuals. I find that very hard to forgive because it doesn't encourage us to be better.
Have you spoken with filmmakers like Cameron? I know Cameron has given his ear to at least one major science fiction writer I can think of who, unless I'm mistaken, has ideologically very different points of view from you. And that would be Scott Card.
Yes, it's amazing how our fan bases overlap and so many people.
I like reading Scott Card. I can't say I appreciate his politics. But he has certainly collaborated with Cameron.
Well, and that's more power to him.
So I'm wondering, how about you?
I'm all in favor of original sci-fi novels that have a strong following getting filmed. Ender's Game by itself, I thought, was a perfectly good example of the Harry Potter effect story.
Mm-hmm.
The reader identifies...
A precursor of the Harry Potter effect story, in fact.
What?
A precursor. It's comes earlier.
It's a standard trope.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been around a long time, and that is the main character is somebody who geeky 12-year-olds who are bullied on the playground can identify with and say, it's all right, my hidden talents haven't shown up yet. And who needs anybody because I'm going to be a demigod?
Yeah.
Where things get tedious, since you raised the subject, is when an author always does that. And when every single story...
I would have to agree with you about that.
...is about demigods who are so much better than humanity that they have the perfect right to derail our politics, wag their fingers at us, and tell us they're taking over for our own good. I don't care for that. It's not my cup of tea. But let me say this. He does it very well.
Mm-hmm.
His demigods wring their hands, and when they're putting their thumbs down on us, they say, this is going to hurt me more than it's going to hurt you. Ow, I'm so disappointed. Ow. And if we're ever, you know, taken over by some demigod ubermensch being, I hope it's an Orson Scott Card character, because at least he won't enjoy it.
There you go. But I'm wondering, I mean, imagine what could be done with the Uplift War in cinema.
Well, the Uplift War, of course, scares people off because it's apes.
Mm-hmm.
And Star Tide Rising, Paramount costed it out at $250 million pre-Avatar. Now it would be a piece of cake to make for a very reasonable budget.
Because both Avatar and John Carter have developed new techniques that have brought, even though they cost so much, they've brought the cost of other films that come after them down.
Yeah, today the only problem is the disease that's rampant in Hollywood, and that is, don't make anything original. It's too dangerous.
Yeah.
And that's...
that's why you have episode 4 and 5 of every franchise that they can do. And they stick to the comic books for the big summer movies. They're not doing so much the science fiction films.
Screed about the popular film 600. I mean 300.
Yeah, yeah.
That was had a little bit of fun tearing that one apart.
Yeah, I have to say I don't need to. I didn't go.
Right. Well, it's when you get absolutely every historical fact completely wrong. You know, fool me once, shame on me, on you. Fool me twice, shame on me.
And right.
Somebody's got an agenda.
Yeah, and after that he made Watchmen, you know, so.
No, different guy.
Was it?
Yeah, Alan Moore versus...
Alan Moore did the... I'm talking about the movies. I believe the director was the same.
Oh, yeah, but I'm talking about Frank Miller, the original.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, Frank Miller versus Alan Moore, correct, yeah.
Right. But in any event, enough gossip. I hate gossip.
Okay, let's... Terrible. Yeah, no, but I was just wondering, actually, I was trying to lead this into what works of yours would you like to see adapted for the big screen?
Well, the major screenwriter, Leslie Dixon, did a marvelous script for Killing People.
Okay, I could imagine that would be so much fun.
It would be fun. There's frequent interest in a short story of mine called Dr. Pack's Preschool.
I remember that.
In which the a woman becomes pregnant and her husband insists that the kid get started on his studies before birth, so he has a teaching unit installed, and she winds up with a womb with a view,
mm-hmm.
so to speak,
as it were.
Actually, there were a whole bunch of amateur scripts that people kept sending me for the practice effect.
Okay,
and that one would be loads of fun.
That would be. I mean, I can't actually imagine anything you've... I mean, I think they could even do Heart of the Comet.
And there was a script made for that as well.
There was, okay.
I think Out of the Comet would be great. I think it would be dynamite.
Yeah, I so do I. I think, you know, if enough people went to see Terrence Malick's film Tree of Life, they could, you know, Heart of the Comet would be a breeze.
Yeah. But you have to get past the problem of the aversion Hollywood has to doing things original.
This is why Nolan
is such an important director, because he takes chances.
I'm sorry, I missed who you said.
Nolan, the guy who
did, Christopher Nolan, yeah. He, I can't say I'm totally satisfied with anything he's made, but he certainly is in the right turf. He's in the right territory. He really takes chances, and he is, if you can use the word in his cinema, he's literate.
Well, he does take chances. That's the main thing. He's willing to. I mean, you come out of Inception almost deaf.
Mm-hmm.
The music was very good, but, you know...
I just didn't care for the fact that Inception finally cut to the chase, literally, and that you had, you know, a whole sequence that could have been out of a James Bond film. You know, that whole snow chase thing, where the movie stopped and the action took over.
Using the fact that you're in a dream, dreams can get very, very vivid, and what they were trying to do was distract the fellow. And James Bond is distracting.
Yeah, it's just that it took too much screen time, and it distracted me. And I shouldn't be distracted from the story at hand.
Right. But, nevertheless, I think the Academy Awards should have a difficulty factor like the Olympics. I mean, once you had that excellent screenplay for The King's Speech, and you had the actors were chosen,
mm-hmm.
all you needed was a cameraman and a sound man.
It's true.
Seriously, with that script and those actors,
you couldn't go wrong.
You did not need a director. All you needed was a cameraman. Maybe blocked out some camera angles.
Yeah, I mean,
And then the actors themselves could have made that movie. Oh, yeah, the costume people. The movie made itself. And so I think that Inception should have had a difficulty factor.
There was one major failing of The King's Speech. That you had a movie with a scene with Jennifer Ely and Colin Firth, and they don't even get to talk to each other. And I am such a big fan of the, I think it was 1995 production that they did of Pride and Prejudice, in which they have so much screen time together. And then here we are 18 years later almost, and they're in the same film and they're in the same scene and they don't even acknowledge each other. I was saddened. That was the fanboy in me.
Well, that's actually a very good point. So in any event, I'd hope that there would be a change to this, and where I think this is all going to change is that technology is going to change everything, and it's not just what I was talking about before about the tendency to have the price of the films go down. Like, we could do Dolphins in Space now. That's not my meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I've done... another thing that I've done across the last 10 years is some graphic novels. One of them came in third over in France, where they love the graphic novel. It was called The Life Eaters, and the first third of it was was based upon my story, Thor Meets Captain America, which came in second for a Hugo back in the 80s.
Right.
And I got to work with the great artist Scott Hampton on that. But the thing is, when you're doing graphic novels, it's very much like writing and directing a movie.
It is.
Not only writing a script, but you're also doing the camera angles, blocking it out for the artist. So, you know, I feel as if I've directed movies. And here's the deal. That's actually going to be a real path in the future.
I think it's a path in the present.
Yes. Well, you have the notion that a writer would be able to work with a photographer, an expert at a computer program that does these blockouts, these storyboards, and then a musician with a synthesizer, and then a few voice actors, and possibly some image capture.
Mm-hmm.
And five or six people would be able to do a full 90-minute animated storyboard of the movie.
What they're going to need to master first is radio. They're going to need to master the voice acting. They're going to need to master all of that in order to make the rest of it work. And it's something that the great filmmakers like George Lucas and Coppola and Cameron and all that, if you listen to the sound of their movies, the sound is rich. The voice acting, whether it's live action or CGI or whatever it may be, the voice acting is superb. So if you're going to go the route that you're talking about, and you did mention the voice acting, they have to get that right. Now, this is the radio producer in me talking, but
yes, it is.
But it's something that, as a radio producer and as a producer of radio drama, I notice is all too often missing. I find it missing even in radio dramas that are now, thank God some of them are being commercially produced. But then what you have are, quote, full cast readings and not actually acted drama.
Well, I totally agree with you. I mean, the first version of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy was a radio show.
Absolutely.
And it's still, despite the others being good, it's still the best.
It's absolutely. And by the way, may I point out, as I love to do, that it made its American debut on this radio program.
That's utterly fabulous.
It is. It is. We were broadcasting a lot of BBC shows for years. We had BBC turntables, which use a proprietary transcription disc format. And a person came around to be interviewed and was promoting a few things and accidentally left behind six discs, each one being a half-hour BBC transcription disc. He did that here, and he did that with our colleague Mike Hodel, now the late Mike Hodel, in Los Angeles, but he did it here about 2 weeks earlier. And so we had a pirated, illegal copy. And I now tell this story because the person in question is dead. So the pirate in question, it can be revealed, was Douglas Adams.
Oh.
Who just wanted to make sure that the damn thing got heard.
Yes, well, sometimes, the writers are sneaky that way.
The writer-producer in that case. But I have to say that between Douglas Adams over there and the Firesign Theater over here,
a couple of the Firesign Theater guys recently passed away.
One, Peter Bergman.
Right.
Yeah.
I back in the 70s, we took bets as to which would be more long-lasting, the Firesign Theater or Monty Python. Well, it turned out to be Monty Python.
Yeah.
Although
every so often, sadly, because of Peter Bergman's death, it is noteworthy that a lot of us radio stations that really have content, there was a feeling in the force. People felt it. It did get broadcast. We gave it many hours here over WBAI. Of course, Firesign Theater came out of Pacifica Radio.
Right. Well, I think we're all bozos on this bus.
Mm-hmm.
It was loads of fun stuff.
Well, Nick Danger premiered here. The Firesign Theater were four members of Pacifica Radio. David Osman, I think it was the music director here at WBAI. And the other guys were, two of them were out of L.A. and one out of San Francisco, but all at the different Pacifica stations. And they got together at some point and created a show called Radio Free Oz. And that was the birth of the Firesign Theater. And it was all here in Pacifica Radio. And the very, very last broadcast they did together about 2 weeks before Peter Bergman died was on KPFK, our L.A. station.
Wow. Wow.
So it started in about 1966, and the last broadcast was earlier this year, a couple of weeks before Bergman died.
That's just amazing.
So it all actually comes out of Pacifica Radio. So we're proud of that.
Well, here's Pacifica Radio.
Yeah, indeed. We have to remind listeners because we're going into fund drive next week, so I hope you all remember that next week. The never-ending fund drive.
And I urge folks to go ahead and support.
Absolutely, and I would like to see the you were talking about the not the middle of the road of politics, but the ending of the division of politics into left and right.
Well, that's just a metaphor for the fact that we can't negotiate right now.
Yeah, exactly. But
politics in America is simply dead. We are in phase three of the American Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And we just have to face that. And it may require a level of vehemence in response to vehemence that we saw in the 1860s.
Yeah.
You know who said something that was remarkably insightful, and it stunned me because I didn't expect insightful things from him. And that's Governor Perry of Texas when he was a candidate for the nomination, and he said that the American Civil War didn't actually begin in 1861. My jaw dropped because I had been just ruminating about that myself, that it began with the Fugitive Slave Act of 1852, when, because of the Dred Scott decision.
Right.
What happened was that bands of irregular Southern cavalry started crisscrossing northern states, Illinois, Ohio, Pennsylvania, crashing through doors, smashing into houses, and carrying away people's neighbors to slavery in the South.
Right.
And when people started gathering to protest, the U.S. Marshals, which were controlled by the federal government, which was owned and operated by the Southern states for about 40 years before the Civil War. So this was never about states' rights.
That's true. I am amazed and almost appalled to hear that Rick Perry had that insight.
Yes, and it's very interesting. I finally figured out what I think his point was, and it was a conservative right-wing point about states' rights. I think his point was that you Northerners suffered the cruel hand of federal overreach back then when the South controlled the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And we experienced your, clutching use of the federal government on us after the Civil War. And I think his point was, let's eliminate the overreach of the federal government. But
nah.
I found.
I'm more of a federalist myself. I like John Adams.
I'm not saying I respect Rick Perry. I'm just saying that one needs to be open to when somebody, even somebody you don't respect,
whatever the source may be,
says something that's really interesting. Because that's how negotiation happens.
Well, I'm going to come around and say again that that's one of the reasons why I love speculative fiction. Because it brings us the voices of things that we're not expecting to hear and often takes it out of the context of the reality here and now, but it holds within it contemporary truths that we have to face.
Right, right. Well, the point is it creates conversation. And in Existence, my new novel,
from
what
Torah
I do
books.
Is I try to give voice to various what I think might be political positions of the next century, of 30, 40 years from now, and try to make them seem as if, for instance, conservatism has changed by then. It's much more conservationist by then, but it's still conservatism.
Mm-hmm.
You have factions that are today's factions, but have mutated and migrated, just as most conservatives today would disclaim any association with Joe McCarthy or with old Jim Crow laws.
Mm-hmm.
Things have changed, but to give your character's voice to what might reasonably be extrapolated to that personality, that point of view, as it might appear in 30 years, and what their opponents might be saying and thinking. You know, the 30 to 50 year time frame for a novel is one of the most difficult, because if you do what Michael Crichton did, and by the way, some people think he's a character in my book,
mm-hmm.
Because there's a tall science fiction author.
Correct, yes.
He does these things.
That's right.
But
would you dissuade people from thinking that?
No. Just basically what he did was a very simple formula.
Mm-hmm.
You take today's world and you throw a disturber into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and usually it is some over-eager scientific breakthrough. And what he never points out is that his disasters wouldn't take place if it weren't for the fact that something else happens, and that is that it's all done in secrecy.
Yeah.
If the dinosaurs are made, or the robot world is made, and it's done in the open, subject to criticism, incremental criticism, then the mistakes that he's talking about doesn't happen.
It's true.
You know, hey, Jurassic Park guy, make the herbivores first.
Exactly.
A billion people will pay to come to your park to see brontosauruses and be safe. And after 10 years, you can then make one T-Rex and a billion more will come back.
Yeah.
You know, it's a crazy situation. I love Spielberg films. I think he's an American genius. But when you watch Jurassic Park, listen to the music when there's a herbivore, and then listen to the music when it's a carnivore.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I hadn't thought of that, but you're right. They run occasionally on Turner Classic Movies a discussion from the American Film Institute on collaboration with John Williams and Steven Spielberg. And it's fascinating to listen to them talk to each other about how collaborative their work is, even though they may be working separately.
Yeah, and it's a lot of back and forth. But my point is that if you go in the time frame that old Crichton used, then that's really easy. You just show today's world, and then you mess it up.
Yeah.
Or you throw in some kind of a change that disturbs people.
Would you like to take phone calls?
Why don't we do that?
Sure. Tell listeners that the telephone number here at WBAI is area code 212-209-2900. And David, let me warn you that, again, I am not extremely well practiced. We are in conference phone mode. And if God forbid I should disconnect you during this procedure, I will just ring you back.
Okay.
But again, and I'm going to wait a couple of minutes. We already have two calls coming in, but I like to have a bunch of calls so I can fasten.
Well, let me just finish
move.
This one.
Oh, please. I'm sorry. Go right ahead.
If you go in the near future, it's fairly easy to write. If you go in the far future, you're constrained somewhat, if you're honest, by the rules of physics and basic biology. Otherwise, you can just posit anything you like I did in Glory Season.
Mm-hmm.
In the 30 to 50-year projection, you have to make a world that is complex and plausibly extrapolated from our own. And you have to have that sense that if you brought your own self from 50 years ago to today, that person, that kid, would be saying half the time, wow, we never thought of that. And the other half the time, the kid would be saying, you mean you're still doing that? And to capture that sense of brilliant progress combined with obstinate stupidity and disappointment, that's something that attracted me to this time scale in Earth and did again in existence.
Yeah.
And
the big cosmic scale.
Yeah, we should tell people what the book is about, I guess.
We should. But before we do that, let me again repeat the phone number, 212-209-2900, and let me just reintroduce that people are listening to Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund. With us by phone near San Diego is David Brin, whose latest novel is Existence from Tor Books. Now you're going to give us a précis.
Oh, well, the thing is, Existence is, you know, I've been heavily engaged in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. For 30 years, I've written papers and been involved in this notorious scientific subject without any, a topic without any subject matter. The Fermi paradox is the question of why we seem to be alone in the cosmos. And there, I've cataloged about 100 explanations. Most of the bright thinkers in the field, like Stephen Hawking, Michio Kaku, they glom onto just one and they say, this is the answer. I don't see how you can say that. So in Existence...
By the way, are you aware that Michio Kaku does his show from this radio station? Another claim
and
of ours.
And I have all the respect in the world for him.
Ah, good.
We've been on shows before.
Ah, okay.
Together.
That's right. It's especially television shows, I believe.
That's right. I just...
But you see, we claim Michio is one of our own.
And he's great.
Yeah.
But I don't believe that people should pick one or two explanations when there's no evidence. What you do is you can rank them in order of plausibility. And to some degree...
I love your answer.
Folks get to see the range of possible explanations for why we seem to be alone in the universe. And then suddenly we're not. An astronaut is in orbit. He's cleaning out garbage from our era to try to keep orbit, low Earth orbit, usable. And he snags with his lariat, his space lariat, a crystal. And people can see hints to this in the lavish, beautiful book preview trailer that we did for Existence with the great web artist, some people out there are going to get very excited by this, Patrick Farley, who does Electric Sheep on the web. He hand-painted all the images you'll see in the trailer. It's 3 minutes, really gorgeous, and it gives a good preview to the... and people can find it. It's prominently displayed simply by going to my website.
Yeah, that's what I was going to point out. It's just go to DavidBrin, DavidBrin.com.
Right. But another interesting thing that callers can ask about is this trend towards having trailers for books.
Yes. I'm very proud of being in a trailer for the Border Town books that the paperback just came out and all that. But I wonder if they actually sell books.
Well, one does wonder. I mean, certainly some people have told me that they watched the trailer and then ran out and ordered the book. But, you know, you try what you can.
You're one of the few people left who publishers actually will say, oh, let's have an author tour. Not too many people are that lucky. I think, you know, they're using trailers as a substitute.
Well, I actually took care of making the trailer, but you're right. Even at my level, you never get a cross-country tour anymore.
Yeah, I was disappointed. I spoke to the publicist before we set up this phone interview, which is so rare for me to do a phone interview. I like people, you know, to quote the Nero Wolfe book, eyes at a level. But the I was disappointed to find out that your tour is a West Coast tour.
Yeah, well, you know, I live on the West Coast, and so they come up with a rationalization that back east people are too blasé about science fiction, so we're only going to do the West.
Yeah, but you get here every so often, government consulting and all that good stuff.
Well, yes, I do, and so I come back east a couple times a year because government agencies, companies, they ask me to come and give future, you know, talks about the future, where things are heading and all that.
Yeah, and I'm always pleased that you always send out an email to those of us who may want to interview you or whatever.
Yeah, well, you know, email is a very civilized method of communication.
Yeah, and so just saying, hi, I'm coming out, do you want me? And it used to be that I had trouble getting to Washington, but I have discovered the joys of the cheap bus trip.
Aha.
It's,
well, you know, if the buses are quality and they have a bathroom.
Well, I mean, the idea of it used to scare the heck out of me, but I would usually drive or take the train, which is very expensive, the train. But I went to Washington for the Nebula Awards this year, and my entire transportation round trip was under $30, New York to Washington.
Wow.
And there are at least two extremely reliable, safe, and hygienically safe as well, bus lines that are doing this.
So, well, speaking of transportation, do we have
Do we have
any callers?
We do.
Here to transport themselves into our minds?
Indeed. We had like four, and then they dropped off. We still have at least one. But let me remind people of the phone number is to speak with David Brin is area code 212-209-2900. And good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James.
Hello.
Yes, James?
Yeah, what's your
name? Well, you're talking to David.
Oh, I'm sorry. Good morning, Mr. Brin. I wanted to talk to you on several levels, but especially as a historian to historian. Interesting that you mentioned the Sioux versus the Cherokee, because I've just finished reading an extraordinary new book on the Trail of Tears called American Betrayal, Cherokee Patriots and the Trail of Tears. I would recommend the book to you very much.
Well, it's very interesting you should say that, because, in fact, my screenwriter partner and I, Tom Abrams, we created a script, and you may be surprised because I'm a science fiction author. We created a script and an outline for a script that we tried to sell back when Ted Turner was doing all of his Indian pitches. And it was about the Trail of Tears, but primarily the stunning and incredible story that led up to the Trail of Tears, which I think is unlike any of the other tales about the mostly sad encounters between Anglo-America and Indian nations.
Now, which story are you referring to? The discovery of gold in Georgia and the Carolinas, or earlier?
I'm talking about the fact that they're the only American Indian tribe whose principal hero is an intellectual who gave them literacy.
Oh, yes.
But primarily, the expedition, the war expedition of John Ross.
Yes.
To the sleepy little hamlet known as Washington, D.C., crisscrossing the South, escaping lynch mobs, so that he would knock on the door of Daniel Webster, who opened the door and said, "Thank God you made it," and welcomed him in to see his other friends, Sam Houston and Davy Crockett, who then helped John Ross to make his case before the United States Supreme Court. And you can imagine this movie within the movie of the trial. and you know that it's going to end in the Trail of Tears. And so everyone in the theater is shocked when the prune-faced judges come in and rule in favor of the Cherokee Nation.
And then, of course, Andy Jackson, whether, in fact, he made that statement, let John Marshall enforce the decision. We're not quite sure if that was ever stated, but it could have been, knowing Andy Jackson as I do, after
good
all...
Good friend of yours?
No, but he did almost start a war with Britain over Florida. You know, he went into Florida in 1819, hanged two British diplomats, and almost started a row, but that's another story. You mentioned the Civil War, and I have to say this, one learns new things every day. Rick Perry, indeed, making a statement that's worth considering, he mentioned the Civil War began 1852 or 1850. I would say the Civil War began in the summer of 1845 with the annexation of Texas, because that was the summer that John L. O'Sullivan, the reporter, made the statement about Manifest Destiny, and because the James Polk administration wished to annex Texas, California, New Mexico, and everything else it could grab, the Civil War, or as Manly Wade Wellman once said to me, the late unpleasantness, which is my favorite term for that period, said that the Civil War really began with the Mexican War, because the Mexican War, as any historian will tell you, was a conflict begun by the Manifest Destiny crowd and the Southern slaveocracy, and that started the whole tilt.
Well, you know, look, complicated things happen, and I'm... certainly, Henry David Thoreau and others, you know, were never very happy with that whole range of things. But I don't think that it was quite as explicit, in that the Northerners did not feel quite as oppressed as they did after the Fugitive Slave Law, when irregular bands of Southern cavalry started rampaging across. Look, it took a fair amount of radicalization to turn them into people who would vote for Abraham Lincoln.
It's true, and it will. And I will tell you that the folks in Kansas will tell you, as in Missouri, that the war actually began in 1854, 55, 56 with Beecher's Rifles and Pottawatomi and Lawrence being burned, not once but twice, et cetera, et cetera. By the way, you mentioned John Ross. Just as a point of information, he has a direct descendant who was one of America's great storytellers. Her name is Gail Ross, out of Central Texas. And she has done many performances about the fact that he was one of the principal chiefs, if not the only one, who fought the treaty or who fought the annexation of those lands to the United States government. And you know, it's interesting that of all the tribes in the United States, they were the ones who suffered most because of the Civil War, because they, along with the Osage, very small tribe in Missouri, were the only two tribes that actually took up the cause of the CSA, and boy, did they suffer for it.
Oh, well, yes.
As you know.
But it's really quite fascinating. I think we've just proved that science fiction folks love history,
mm-hmm.
which was one of my core points.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that if my students in 40 years had had the acumen that you have, I must tell you that I totally agree with you that we are so porous in history. I don't even get me on that discussion. Then the blood level will rise. But meanwhile,
well, yes. But if I could possibly point out something, you know, we have a tendency to degrade and denigrate our American school systems, and to some degree, with good reason. I mean, I've had kids go through them, but you know, I'm contrary. So whenever I see something that's become a cliche, I look for evidence of the other side, just in case there's something to be said there. Yet if our schools are so bad, how come we have 90 of the 100 best universities on the planet? Well, here's a piece of news that just came out recently that the news media did not know what to do with. So they just ignored it. And that is, there was a survey of adults worldwide, not students, but adults, on science literacy. And they found that worldwide science literacy just sucks.
Yep.
Because the number one country had a 14% science literacy rate. But that was twice the number two country. And you know what the number one country was in adult science literacy?
No.
Well, of course you don't, because it violates all of our preconceptions. It was the United States of America.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
And the reason actually is very, very clear. I've lived overseas twice. I've lived in England for 2 years. I've lived in France for 2 years. And I suddenly realized that their baccalaureate degree, their bachelor's degree, takes 3 years nominally. Nobody does it in 3 years. Sometimes they take 30 over there. Takes 3 years nominally instead of four. And I asked why. And they said, well, because your students are so stupid. And then I suddenly realized they go to college at age 17 and specialize from the word go. You start medical school at 17. You start to become a lawyer at 17. You study just one thing at 17. And this is a means of keeping control. It means that the boffins, the scientists, the engineers, are never exposed to the history of English that they would need in order to start thinking about their role in the world.
Listen, I would just like to point out, you know, point of information, that we have 3 minutes to the show left.
Oh, all right. Well, then I'll race through this. The thing is that the breadth requirements in the American university are what make up the extra year. And every English major is required to take three courses of science and two of math. And every math student is required to take, you know, several history and English. And so they can think that they might get a law degree on the side or an MBA on the side. And that resulted in the science literacy. Let's try to take one more call.
Okay, very good.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. And good morning, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm calling the lobby. Security.
Okay, you're calling the wrong number. You're on the air.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay.
Okay, David, are you still there? Oh, damn. Okay, folks, hang on with me. That did hang up on our guest, and I need to get him back so we can at least say goodbye properly. So, Lister, forgive me. This is going to take a moment. First thing, I have to get his phone number. Ah, dear. I am not expert in our conference call system here. And, Lister, you know how this works. Could you just help me make this call? It's this number here. You know, and there it is. One that says David Brin. And let me remind people who, because David is still off the air, his latest novel is called Existence from Tor Books. I can do it. I mean, I have to do this immediately. Immediately. Okay, hold on. Let me just, I'll do it. Okay, yeah, I need my glasses, unfortunately. Okay, let's dial. Okay, here are my glasses, thank you. I need glasses to do radio. Okay, let's put those on again, and let's dial him. And it's okay if we hear it on the air. It's, That's not dialing. Okay, so there we are. And we are ringing. Hi, David. Sorry, hold on. Let's put you back on. There. Well, there's at least us. So hold on. Let me put you back on the air. Uh, Okay, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I am so sorry. That was my foul up. You know, I said I'm never comfortable with, you know, the conference call system, and by hitting the off button, as I did, I disconnected not only the phone call coming in from the lobby downstairs, but you as well, which is the last thing I wanted to do. And at this point, I should be playing my outro music, but I wanted to do a more graceful outro. So, first of all, so let's...
Why don't I read a couple chapters from my book?
That would be excellent, yes. In compressed format, right?
Indeed.
Indeed. We actually did have you reading Kiln People about 10 years ago.
Yes, that was fun.
That was wonderful. You were reading to a convention, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'll be at WesterCon, the West Coast Convention, this coming weekend, but that's not in...
Next week I'll be at ReaderCon, by the way, which is one of my favorite all-time conventions.
And, of course, the World Science Fiction Convention is held in Chicago this August.
Right. I will be giving that a pass, but I will be, but I don't think you will be, at World Fantasy.
Not this time. I was at last time.
That's right.
But
that's right.
In any event, I'd like to say to your audience, think positively about the future. Constantly question things.
Constantly question. I like the message of think positively.
Well, we've got to become, again, Neal Stephenson, Greg Bear, Kim Stanley Robinson, and I have all decided we're going to join together in a campaign to, you know, bring back the notion that science fiction that warns is great.
Yes.
And warn us of errors, terrific. By all means, do that. But the gloom and the cynicism is a cop-out.
The Cassandra-ism of science fiction.
Ray Bradbury, the fact is we've all benefited so much from this fragile, recent, and human enlightenment. And if darkness and feudalism come back, well then, you know, I don't think they're going to let enlightenment return again. And we won't have any chance of seeing Star Trek. We've got to overcome our errors, and we're all part of it. And we've all got to get back to negotiating with each other.
I think that's a wonderful message. Well, you know what? I'm going to be having Stan Robinson on the show very shortly.
Well,
so we'll continue that with him.
Very longly.
I'm sorry?
Have him on the show very longly.
Yes, absolutely. That would be good. Well, we'll give him 90 minutes as we did you. And I told you it's all too short.
Well, that's awful personal.
That one, indeed it is. But let's remind people, because we're running out of time, that the latest novel is Existence from Tor Books. For more information, to see the trailer, and to learn about all the other wonderful books by David Brin, remember that name and go to davidbrin.com, DavidBrin.
And by all means, continue with The Hour of the Wolf, because it is one of the treasures of human civilization.
Well, thank you. 40 years running now. 40 and a half years. God help me.
Indeed.
Indeed. David, I can't thank you enough.
Well, you already have.
Well, not enough. But thanks so much for being here. And you and I will talk in email.
And we'll talk some more, Jim.
Very
good.
Good
luck to you all.
Thanks. Take care. Good morning. And, okay, now, this time I hung up properly. That, you know, I always somehow screw up dramatically, and this time the show was going fine until, like, the last 2 minutes. And, you know, I should have known. But let me say to people, thank you all for listening. Visit OurWolf.com, OurWolf.com, and you can hear the archive of this show from there. I'll have a link to DavidBrin.com from there, but you can go straight to David Brin, so to speak. And even though the site looks very old, there's lots of current goodies within. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister next week. I'm not sure if I'm back or not. I will be in Massachusetts for ReaderCon, but I may be here. And the week after that, we certainly hope to have a another special Ray Bradbury tribute. Thanks again for listening. Take care of yourselves and have a wonderful time. As David said, think positively about the future. It might just work.
Sails of silver. Talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nick.
Boston, South Central, L.A., California, I.A., Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy. Never ran, never will, Brownsville. Boogie down, South Bronx, yeah. My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? Think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I touch the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
Cinco. Yeah.
It's so divine, it can make you
list alive, yeah.
Feel a little better now.
Flag burning day, July 4th. How you doing, y'all?
Stay with me all night, I rock you one time. Come on, come on, come on. I wanna make you feel a little better now.
Feel a little better now. Come make we Dobie, and we feel a little better. Come make we Dobie, and we